Hi again, everybody. John Porteous of the Lovells Township Historical Society here, and you're listening to the Backcast Podcast. Hey, welcome back. Delighted to have you. Welcome, new listeners. We've got, in our ongoing series of celebrating women in fly fishing, the theme of our Trout Museum displays this year, we have Vanessa Perry with us today, Richard's daughter, and she's kindly dubbed it the nepotism episode. Vanessa's just an extremely talented and experienced young lady. Aside from all of her work with cold water conservation and recreation, she also is a classically trained concert cellist. So, multidimensional and very entertaining. So, without further ado, let's meet Vanessa. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Richard, how are you this morning?
Doing well. Can't complain.
Good, good. Hey, we've got a special guest with us today. In fact, Richard, I'm going to let you introduce our guest because you have a special relationship with her.
This morning we're joined with Vanessa Perry. Should have forgot your name. With my daughter, who has got a... background since her early high school days working with environmental issues, and now she's with the Minnesota DNR after spending some time in the Peace Corps and doing a lot of interesting environmental type stuff, you know, that I got a claim of ignorance to in many cases.
So, well, we'll all learn together. I mean, yeah. This is, Vanessa, you're pretty much epitomize our, celebration of women in fly fishing. You've taken it kind of next level and gone all career with it and everything. So if you would, introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about your background and your maybe just touch on your fishing a little bit.
Sure, thanks. Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and this can be your nepotism episode.
But, yes, yeah, exactly.
Man. So
not everybody can have one of those.
That's right, no. Vanessa Perry, and I am Richard's daughter, and I think because I'm Richard's daughter, I got to grow up spending quite a lot of time outside camping and fishing, and started early on the water doing real fishing at grandma's house on the lake, and spent a lot of summers catching sunnies and learning how to hook a worm and handle a fish, and I think that started me out early with an appreciation of being outside and being around water, and then traveled a lot growing up, which I think, to the national parks and some of those great gyms and camping and being outside. And I think that, again, really shaped my appreciation of natural places and being outside. And then that led into a passion and a career in natural resources and natural resources management. So, yes. Yeah, started in high school working with local watershed districts and watershed organizations in Central Ohio, and then went to Ohio State and focused on policy and planning, environmental policy and planning. And
we do have Ohio listeners, so we'll not, give you the normal razz about Ohio State.
That's right. Yeah. Appreciate that. The Ohio State University.
Yes, yes.
Thank you very much. And and then continued on from there. So did some time in the Peace Corps working for national parks in Macedonia and southeastern Europe, right on the Greek-Albania border.
What was that like? I mean,
yeah, pretty
language barriers, or?
Well, so they are great in making sure that you have the language and cultural skills you need. That's one of the things Peace Corps is really, really invested in. So spent 3 months living with a family and learning language.
So total immersion then.
Total immersion, yep. So learned Macedonian, learned a little Greek, learned a little Albanian. A little Turkish, and I actually had the opportunity just last October to go back and visit with my husband, and I went back and visited, and so spent some time in Albania and went back to my old Peace Corps site, and got to visit some friends that I knew from 20 years ago, and yeah, pretty amazing.
Well, the naive question is, did you do anything in that project that would have grown and that you could have seen evolve on your revisit?
Yeah, you know, only that the one gal that we visited with, she said that she ended up studying abroad in Italy, and now she works internationally in pharmaceutical sales. And she said one of the reasons that she did that is because of the she had been in high school when I was there, and she said she did that because of her time working with Peace Corps volunteers and how special it was for her to...
How awesome is that?
Yeah, but I really felt like I had, like, sort of learned... I took much more from that experience than I gave, especially then as a young... You know, I didn't really know what I was doing and how to... I mean, I had formal education and natural resources, but I don't know that I knew much about how to contribute. And yeah.
Well, you learned how to get rakia back into the country. So.
Yeah, rakia, the local liquor, which is homemade. It's about 70 proof, and they'll use it to drink sort of all day long, and they'll use it to clean with. So, but
it's a versatile product.
Yeah, it's a versatile. potent.
Potent drain cleaner. You take a drink of it, and you definitely clears your sinus.
Yeah, so I got some of that back home.
Cure colds, clean counters.
Yep, that's right.
Awesome, right. Awesome. Well, you now this is still early days, right? With the Peace Corps involvement.
Yeah, that was immediately after college, and I will say that, you know, one of my themes in my career has been, I think, really this sort of people part of natural resources and this interaction between how people are making decisions and how that affects our natural resources. And I think a lot of folks go into natural resource management because they like being outside, they like fishing, they like animals, and they don't necessarily like people. You know, go into resources because you want to be outside and you don't want to be with people. And then I think a lot of folks are disappointed when they end up having to manage people more than they end up managing natural pieces. So I've found sort of a niche where I'm thinking a lot about how people interact with the environment and how biophysical scientists can learn from how people are making decisions. And I will say, as a lot of that I picked up actually from Peace Corps, because thinking about, you know, my perspective I was bringing about, you know, what the right, quote, right way of managing an environmental issue would be, and really having to adjust that to a new culture and the way people were thinking about litter and environment.
I was going to say, can you give us a little maybe real world?
Yeah. So for example, the community I was living in, it was one of the longest inhabited, like continually inhabited locations in the world. So people have been living there for 3,000 years, and it's on one of the deepest lakes in the world. And so it has like an endemic trout species that's essentially like a prehistoric, you know, trout fish, and endangered, of course, but also really valued for soup. You know, like,
oh, really?
And so if you go to the right restaurant,
don't look, we're taking,
yeah, exactly,
trout.
It's a specialty on the menu. And so thinking about sort of how to knit together like management of this endangered, endemic, super rare trout species in a really vulnerable ecosystem with something that's really culturally important, you know, became a different kind of challenge.
Yeah.
So just like sort of resetting, and it wasn't going to work to regulate, you know, or enforce, because people were going to skirt around the system and find ways to do it anyway. So it was going to be a little bit more of a complicated management issue. But just, yeah, so that cultural context, that sort of early thinking about how communities and how people make decisions became really important to my sort of framing.
That's amazing. Yeah, there's, well, target-rich environment, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pointed out the flaws in the forced compliance model.
Yeah, right.
Well, after your Peace Corps experience, you didn't exactly stop there. You've got a lot of stuff going on. What followed the Peace Corps?
Yeah, so then I spent some time in Montana, working in Ravalli County, so south of Missoula, for the county out there, and I was doing land use planning, but also some floodplain management, and then had the chance to work on their open lands bond program. And so this was another really cool program where they were doing conservation easements, so protection of property, but they had paired together working lands, so farmlands, ranching lands, and wildlife. So they had $10 million available, and it was easements for both working lands and wildlife lands. So this was another example of where, like, they were really tailored a program to the local community needs, where if it had just been wildlife, they would have had, like, a huge conflict over getting it passed. And if it had just been working lands, then that wouldn't have worked either. Yeah, exactly. So they got the farmer ranching community and the wildlife community working together to get this bond passed. And in a place where, you know, where local government is probably less popular than other places in the country,
well,
you know.
There's a lot of emotion that, you know, goes in its young history, if you will. Aside from the cultural conflicts, you've got some natural predators involved, too, that have to be tricky. How did you address that?
With predator management?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of the predators, at least in this valley, had been extirpated, and it was, but they did have, you know, so they were managing more of grazing species, like on the federal lands, things like elk that were actually then coming down onto, like, some of the property. So it was more of, like, a human-wildlife interaction that was less of a predator interaction and more of some of the grazing species interactions. But, so I helped manage that program, and it was another really neat experience to get to work with the community on doing some really positive work and positive projects. And then later that I was able to do some land trust work after I moved to Minnesota, then that was kind of set me up to think about doing land protection, private land protection work later in my career.
Okay. So how does that private versus public?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, so the majority of our important conservation areas are in private ownership, you know, so to really meet long-term in the United States, you know, so if we're thinking about how we knit together habitat, you know, habitat corridors, like how we preserve places for species, our important species, whether it's aquatic species or whether it's terrestrial species, like we're just not going to do that just on public spaces, like just on state or federal homeland. Like, that's just not going to be enough place.
We kind of need partnership with those other landowners.
Yeah, we need private landowners. And so if there's a way for private landowners to voluntarily put some protections on their property and maybe get a little financial incentive to do that, where there's a public benefit, but it stays in private ownership, stays on the tax rolls, you know, stays in private ownership, it still is in private use, but has some additional restrictions
some
on it in order
with.
To protect.
Is this like a land conservancy thing that we might be familiar with around here?
Yeah, most states have conservation easement programs of some kind, and you know, some states have more intensity or more frequency than others. Like, the model sort of picks up some places more than others, but like in Minnesota, we have essentially one big conservation easement organization, and then some of the national groups, but I don't know, Michigan, what your sort of models
look like. It seems
like
we've got a lot.
Yeah. Some places have, like, every county will have a conservation.
There's almost, it's not quite at the township level, but it was kind of impressive for me moving in here to kind of learn that, well, there are a lot of groups overlapping each other, and all for the good.
Right, yeah.
But it is...
Yeah.
Somewhat overwhelming. It's like, okay, got to talk to everybody.
Yeah. So that's sort of just and really, it's like the kind of conservation landscape, if you will, is like too big for any one agency or person or organization to manage. Like, there's just going to be too much going on. So it is going to be, we're going to need private entities and private landowners and organizations and nonprofits, and it's really going to be everybody sort of doing their thing that they're best at. And governments are going to be best at some things, and private owners are going to be best at some things, and nonprofits are going to be best at other things, and so it's going to be people working together.
Well, and I think that's kind of reflective of current times, you know, nationally anyway, and that a lot of state agencies are challenged in their funding that they're provided with in order to, you know, run their day-to-day operations and their, you know, aspirational projects and stuff. So
yeah.
We're seeing, you know, shock studies were once the sole domain of the DNR here. Now we're seeing conservation groups get involved with the DNR's guidance, and they're able to carry that torch forward and have nice continuous data streams.
Right, yeah. And finding those,
you know,
areas.
Question marks and holes and such. So.
Yeah, and finding that partnership is really important. So. Yeah.
That's neat. So, well, in and along that line, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but you completed some work within the last few years kind of in and along that line, and as it relates to Minnesotan rec usage and funding.
Yeah. So I've been with the Minnesota DNR now for about 4.5 years. One of the projects I led there was looking at the conservation and outdoor recreation funding model. And so this, many of your listeners may be familiar, is something that folks have been sort of grappling with all over the country. And so a lot of the funding that traditionally has come in for conservation has come sort of on the backs of our hunters and anglers through license sales. And really, disproportionately, hunters and anglers have sort of borne the burden of funding conservation in a lot of places across North America. We call it the North American model. It's, you know,
okay,
versus the European model or the way they fund conservation in some other parts of the world. But it's through license sales. So you hunting, angling license sales, and that pays for protection and management of species as well as other conservation activities. And certainly there's budgets are more complicated than just that, but that's a big part of budget. So
does your experience with in understanding and mapping all this out, we can constantly hear, you know, licenses are down, youth licenses are down, yada yada yada, are you seeing increases in other areas? I don't know, snowmobilers, quad people.
So at least on the Minnesota side, so we're seeing shifts. So our hunting fishing numbers are relatively stable in absolute numbers, so like in the sheer number of people, but as a percentage of population, then it's down over the last 50 years. So if that makes sense. So total number of people is about the same, but then fewer people in the percentage of population, and the demographics are shifting a little bit. So we in Minnesota, we were looking and seeing like long term that license sales weren't going to be a sustainable way to fund conservation in the way that it had been. And we also did some studies and we realized we were getting like towards the limit of what people were willing to pay. Like we were about to start pricing people not quite, but getting close to that. And ultimately, like, these are public assets, right? Like it's like public should be able to have access to these public places and public fish and hunting. And
sure.
So started to think about a little bit different ways, and we are seeing changes in uses and changing in demands. And during the pandemic, like our use and the outdoors in Minnesota went up about 20%, like our state park entrances and so people were using outside, like it was a place to go, it was a refuge when other things were closed. And that's dropped a little bit, but we're seeing those numbers remain higher than they were pre-pandemic.
Is trapping included in the hunting part over there?
Hunting and trapping, yeah. Although that's a smaller percentage of what we see people doing.
Yeah.
But so just thinking about like how we can think about that, and part of it is diversifying fees. It's thinking about other users, snowmobilers, bird watchers,
kayakers,
okay. Bikers, mountain bikers.
Mountain bikers,
especially folks that may have like high infrastructure needs, like if you need trails and
trails
like
maintained,
chains,
right,
and things like that. Like, so that's part of the conversation. Also thinking about building in some like new creative mechanisms. Like we've got some, is there something in legislation, like an adjustment with inflation automatically? Like we get stuck because we have to go back to the legislature every year and whenever we want to adjust fees, but could they adjust with inflation? You know, it's kind of wonky and it's not that exciting. but it's important, well, and right.
I mean, it's the part of the equation that few people really want to talk about or understand. Because it is complex, and it is lots of ins and outs. But the bottom line is it allows for more people to participate in more different ways than ever before, and still have access to access sites or launches whatever.
Brad Jensen from Huron Pines did a hot stove with us. Geez, I don't know, maybe before you guys moved up here. Mm-hmm. It's been a while, we were over warblers, but he identified this exact issue, is that the downturn in traditional outdoor activities and the emergence of mountain biking and power hiking and rock climbing, as opposed to, and that he suggested then, I believe, not putting words in his mouth, that something like this needed to occur, over here as well.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, what we did, we started a little bit, because we knew not everybody was going to care. Like, there's what, like 2 dozen people that, like, truly care about concert, really want to get in the weeds on this thing. So we started by asking people, like, what do you want the future of recreation and outdoor, like, activities to look like and conservation to look like in Minnesota, and had that conversation first. And sort of it was during COVID, so we had an online platform that people could respond to, and we did host some meetings in person.
Nice.
And then use that information to say, like, okay, let's now back into how we would get there. So what does that future look like? And then what are the steps that would actually get us there on the funding side? Because starting the question of, like, what do you want funding to look like in the future? Like, that's just, it's, like, too boring, and it's too in the...
Yeah, everybody ignores it until you do it. You complain about what you did.
So the people that you're surveying, were those, we have this recreation pass that we can get with our license plate here.
Yeah, the Michigan recreation pass came up a lot as a potential model.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that people were interested in, so...
Well, but did your thing unearth any other activities that were like, holy crap, I didn't even think about that, or I didn't suspect that people were as engaged with that particular activity? Anything like that?
And for as far as recreation activities?
Yeah, look in your forward looking.
The ones that surprised us, I think, were just how quickly, like, needs and preferences are changing. Like, there's a lot of, like, trends that come up. So, and so it will be, it's stand-up paddleboarding, and then it's hammocking, and then it's fat tire biking, and then it's, and it's, like, these, how quickly, like, and then it's, people are doing small groups, and then it's large family gathering groups. And so getting, our state park folks, like, had to pivot pretty quick and figure out, like, how can all our picnic tables are bolted down, like, how can we get them so people can put tables together and have big gathering, so it's those sort of ways, like, how do we be more nimble and, like, adapt as preferences change really quick and people kind of follow
these
trends.
These things
and
come
stuff.
And go, like, you don't see lawn darts hardly any place anymore.
That's right.
Such a drag.
Yeah,
a little dangerous, but still a high degree of fun.
Right.
In all seriousness, did that evolve to the point where you perhaps gave more autonomy to individual destinations to cater to their local needs more?
Yeah, I think that will be part of it. That's and how that works.
I don't know if I'm saying
I think. Well, I think what we did, we heard really strongly from folks is they want it to be adaptable, and they want it to be able to shift as the needs of Minnesotans shift. And our demographics are changing quite a bit, and thinking about, like, how do we serve Minnesotans now and how do we serve Minnesotans in the future? But as we age, as we become more diverse, racially diverse and economically diverse. And so, like, how do we continue to serve Minnesotans in a lot of different ways?
How do you grow and scale?
And so, that those were really important conversations, and that being, like, more nimble was going to be part of that, and so that was an important outcome. But thinking about how that actually looks is going to be, we're going to have to continue to figure that out.
It's pretty cool, Vanessa. Yeah. That's really exciting to have your fingers on the pulse of the future that way.
Yeah, it was cool. It was a cool project, and it was fun. It was it was positive, and it was future looking, and I think folks were glad to be. It's, again, it's like, not the most exciting topic, but I think folks were excited to be talking about something that was positive and future-looking and ultimately pretty important for conservation.
I should think. Yeah. I should think. Well,
and I will just say, I'll just have to give, like, accolades to our DNR leadership for really prioritizing that among everything that was going on and really setting that as a key project for the agency in a time when, like, there's lots of things we could be paying attention to, and to be paying attention to something that's, you know, forward-looking and positive was a big deal.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we kind of jumped ahead, and I, you know, kind of blew our timeline chronology, that not that we're structured, but you've got a great deal of experience after your college days and before you joined the Minnesota DNR. Would you tell us, expand a little bit more on that?
Sure.
Because you've been all over the place.
Yeah, so I think the major gap in the timeline then is probably my time in grad school. So I went to University of Minnesota, and I was in the Forest Resources Department there. I did my master's and my PhD, so you can call me doctor if you
Thank
wish.
Thank you, Dr. Perry.
You don't have to. And
that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You can't fix a hangnail, you're not a doctor.
Yeah, not that kind of doctor. And yeah. And really focused on how individuals and how communities are making decisions about natural resources. So my master's work was up in the Red River Basin of Minnesota, up in the far northwest part of the state, working with farmers on how they were or were not adopting conservation behaviors around water on their farms.
So ag runoff or?
Ag runoff, yeah, thinking about cover crops and terracing and all the sorts of practices, and spent a lot of time driving big trucks up to northern Minnesota in January, and only got stuck once. Only had to get pulled out of a snowbank one time.
Well, I remember from my months with FEMA that DCPA that area floods a lot too.
It does flood a lot. It's so flat. I've never been anywhere so flat.
So flat.
So I mean it will drop several feet over several miles. I mean, it's really.
Well, they get a they should get a good exchange of farmland.
Yeah.
From year to year.
No doubt. Yeah. Well. Yeah, myriad of questions there, but I'll hold off on that. So were they able to employ terracing? Did that help?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, places where they had some hills.
Everybody that's driven on
yeah.
the interstate see yeah. low swales and ag
yeah.
fields. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, it ultimately with the farmers we talked to, it came down to, like, farming is a lifestyle. Like, they have a strong commitment. It's also a business. Like, it's both of those things. And the, you know, the folks I talked to, they said, like, we want to do this. We want to do right by the land. We want to do what we need to for conservation. But, like, we can't do it if I don't have my farm. You know, if I don't have the property anymore, I can't do anything.
Right.
And so a lot of it was about ag commodities and farm bills and, like, things that are way bigger than anything going on locally. And the sorts of decisions they were making. And so, we're again, really interested in doing what they could to, because they were committed. They had been there. Their families were there. Their kids were going to be there. They wanted to take care of the land, and they needed to keep the business viable. So,
I mean, just what you said right there, the kids are going to be there. That's, I think, encouraging, because that's not always the trend.
Yeah.
Some of the families that, and having grown up in central Indiana and primarily, you know, outside the city, it's all ag. So but you see now, as these metropolitan areas are experiencing a little bit of sprawl, and there's incentive for families to say, well, maybe I don't want to farm anymore.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And so I think it's super encouraging that kids are staying.
Yeah, I think there's some of that. There's certainly lots of, you know, there's lots of shifts, and we actually, many of the people we spoke to up there were female owners of properties who were sort of new independent owners.
Wow.
Because their husbands had died, and so now they were trying to figure out how to run the property, and sort of interesting differences in some cases about how women landowners were thinking about conservation versus like long-term male landowners,
but more open to newer ideas
sometimes, and like a little bit more of a land ethic in some cases. I don't want to overgeneralize, but
no,
yeah,
full respect. Yeah. And you're dealing with a small slice of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So
still pretty cool.
Yeah.
So you did backing up a bit. You did internships with the Ten Sleep Nature Conservancy folks.
Yeah, I worked out in the Nature Conservancy out in Ten Sleep, Wyoming, and spent a couple summers out there.
That had to be pretty fun.
Super fun. That's amazing, amazing property and place. Like that, these deep canyons with petroglyphs, and I don't know if you remember there's this cave out there.
There's a picture of it right up there.
And there's they've got all these it's sort of a deep cave up on the up off the river there, and it's got like grain and corn and berries and like just a bunch of different things growing right there. And it's because the indigenous people lived in the area. That's where they would sit and prepare food, and like all that, those sort of remnants of things are still growing there. Yeah, very cool. It's just
awesome.
I've had lots of opportunity to just sort of test lots of things and explore lots of places. So, and that's been one of the benefits.
That had to be pretty special though.
Yeah.
Vibe wise, interacting with that.
Oh yeah. It's pretty. Yeah.
No, to my knowledge, you've never been to Disneyland, right?
I've not been to Disneyland. Yeah. balance. Yeah, it's on balance.
Yeah, it's a lot better out hiking on a trail than standing in a line for Space Mountain.
Yeah, that's right. Different. It's different.
Yeah, a little different, but, to each their own. In the middle of all these adventures, is your fly rod with you? Or you?
Yeah, as often as I can.
Do you ever get a chance
sneak
off? And...
Yeah, so certainly, it's out in Ten Sleep, got to do some of that. And when I was in Montana, I lived about a 5-10 minute walk up from the river there, and so got to easy fishing on some of the best rivers, and don't get out in Minnesota as often as I'd like, unfortunately, but we've got some great rivers down in the Driftless. My new work is working on the Mississippi more and doing some work coordinating our conservation work on the Mississippi, so I'm hoping I can just sort of tuck that in the back of my car and spend a little bit more time.
Just throw a little extra few things in
exactly.
The vehicle.
Yeah, and got it, two years ago, we, husband and I went to Alaska. I was trying to get to all 50 states before I turned 40, and Alaska was my last one.
No kidding.
Yeah, so, and then spent a day on the Katmai, getting out with a guide, and got great fish, and yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was great.
Look at you smile.
Yeah,
our listeners can't see
it,
but she is grinning like a...
Yeah, it was fun.
These are clearly good memories.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite hatch, or is there, favorite time of year, or favorite, kind of something emotion evoking?
Well, I think some of my more vivid memories are actually fishing in North Georgia. Like, that's where I, it felt like I really sort of... solidified.
Okay.
That's where we learned to cork fly.
Yeah. I'd love to try some winter fly fishing and get out. I haven't done that, but we've got a long shoulder season in Minnesota where it's I'd love to get out and see.
Yeah, it's interesting how that northern climate. Awesome. Well, and again, I apologize. We were talking beforehand, and you've been so many places that I'm.
you got that Peace Corps return project going.
Oh,
talk
about
that.
Yeah, thank you.
So I mentioned my master's, and then my PhD was also focused on social science, like the human bit of natural resources management. And so I was able to, more recently, as a return Peace Corps volunteer, they had a they did sort of a call for online virtual service. And I think this was sort of an offshoot of the pandemic. They were looking for ways for people to continue to be involved, and their host countries can put out a call for very specific short-term service requests for returned Peace Corps volunteers. Okay. And so there was a university in the southern Philippines, Bontoc University, in Bontoc, the Southern Leyte University, and their fisheries program, which is really focused on coastal mangrove management and working with local communities on coastal mangrove management and fisheries there. They were interested in working with somebody on incorporating social sciences into their biophysical fisheries program. So how to sort of work with the community more effectively. And so that is a good fit for me. And so I've been working with them. It was February through June, so I'm just about done with that.
Okay.
I've essentially been doing a semester course online. So I meet with them twice a week. It's 20 students and 6 or 7 faculty, and we meet and talk about methods and analysis and why I think about people and natural resources and how to,
What are some of their, they have volcanic challenges at the moment, but what are some of their people challenges in that regard?
Yeah, so they've got they've got a lot of folks are moving around a lot, and so they have sort of long-term traditional communities that are having big influx of new residents that are trying to learn how to fish and live in the mangroves and with the mangroves. And
okay.
So a lot of forests are being cut down, and of course they're good for coastal erosion, they protect, and they're also important for fishery, in fish spawning areas and habitat. And so folks are cutting those down. They're using them for shrimp farming. They're developing homes there. They're putting roads in. They're
Is this because of economic development or improvement, or is it kind of a subsistence model? They're moving to where the food is.
Yeah, it's both. And so it's subsistence and not necessarily having other options. There was also a program during pandemic where the government encouraged people in the cities, or when there wasn't as much work in the cities, they encouraged people to go back to traditional communities where they had lived.
Okay.
But then
so,
didn't send
so
them.
So there really are people from cities coming
yeah,
into.
Yeah, but didn't send them necessarily, they didn't necessarily have skills or the know-how. they had sort of lost that generational know-how of how to be in those environments.
The concerns they had up in Bristol Bay about
big time.
Yeah.
Learning, losing that cultural connection.
Yeah. And I think the approach that folks have had from the university is they just need to know more, which is a very tempting approach, right? And we use that a lot here. If people knew what I knew, they would do what I do.
Uh-huh.
and that's very tempting. But what we know from lots of research in social psychology is that we can know the same thing and still act really differently.
Oh,
and
sure.
So knowledge isn't actually the solve that we want it to be. And so we need to sort of understand the other motivators of behavior.
The local context variable has to enter into that equation in a big way.
But so it's about economy and identity and your culture and your history, and it's all those things. And if you can sort of tease that apart a little bit, you may be able to find some sort of nuance.
I've got to ask, just now that it's a very selfish question, but relative to that, for these people that, that's their life in these communities, a very basic lifestyle, I'm assuming. And now you've got people from more populous areas coming in, and to your point, not with the same skills. How did the old school people respond?
No, that's a great question that I don't know the answer to, because I've been working mostly with the folks at the university, and we're thinking about how they can work with those communities more effectively.
Gotcha.
But that's a great, great question, and I think that's something they should. I would hope that they would explore more, because that's probably a big tension point.
We're just setting you up for the
segue,
next year
I'll come back. I'll let
we'll
you know.
The,
yeah, yeah. yeah.
We're introducing cannibalism.
So it's
is that an option? No. The but you've done some other domestic experiences. and again, in earlier years, out in the Bay Area?
Yeah. So I was in college. I spent a semester working with the National Park Service in San Francisco. So I lived right on the Presidio.
Nice.
Yep, which was pretty cool. And then worked for the
Definitely worst places you could pick.
Yeah, right. And especially if you're going to live there for free.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's hard to find housing that's that good of a location for that price in the Bay Area. But worked for the Golden Gate National Recreation Area and did interpretive education programs. So worked on the Ocean Beach right there and worked with kids and then went up in Muir Woods doing programs. And then I worked on the Nike nuclear missile site. So we do like Cold War programming. So we take students.
It's just so surreal up there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So take students down in the missile silo and then we turn on the alarms and like.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. But it was, that's where I learned I didn't want to do environmental education.
Yeah.
Like, that wasn't going to be my passion.
Don't want to kick around old Nike installations.
Yeah. It was a great experience, but I realized I wasn't going to be, I didn't have the patience and, enthusiasm to be an environmental educator or a teacher long term. So it's important to learn what you don't want to do also.
Well, every bit as much as what you do. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
I've never learned what I really want to do, but I've got a pretty good insight to what I don't want to do.
Learning new don't want to do is every day. So
But I've been very fortunate to be able to try lots of things. And I was talking to a young person, a high school student the other day who we have like an environmental high school in the Twin Cities. And I'm not quite sure how they found my name, but they were calling like, they were clearly assigned to do interviews as part of a end of school year project.
Awesome. Okay.
Podcast.
Yeah. And so I think the words of wisdom that I shared with them were, you know, just show up and try stuff and you know, if it doesn't work, then you've learned something important as well. And so, and that they will make lots of connections just by being in a place and showing up. And that is a huge deal, especially these days when so much can be done online, like just like actually physically showing up is a huge deal for people. So,
well, yeah, I mean, the balance always exists between the theoretical and the practical, and it's to your point, get out there and do something.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, what's next? What's, I suppose we should touch on this. You are an accomplished concert cellist. we've got, the real Renaissance lady here. You've got, you know, all this myriad of experience in the outdoors, plus a heavy tilt towards a classical instrument.
Yeah. So I've been playing with our JCC, our Jewish Community Center Orchestra, which has been around for 90 years in the Twin Cities and is a really spectacular full symphony. So I played with them for several years. I took a little bit of a break during the pandemic, but would love to get back with them. And then I also picked up mandolin and violin.
Oh, wow.
I picked up a violin out of a dumpster at the end of my alley. I found it sitting there and I took it to the repair shop and it turned out it was like a 1770 like handmade wood top. Yeah, like
you rescued
I rescued
an
it
artifact.
Yeah, it was a you know, it's not the nicest, but it's a pretty good instrument and paid a little bit of money to get it rehabbed, and I paid much less to get it fixed than it was worth. So I've got this much, much nicer violin than I deserve. And so it's...
That's a jaw-dropping story.
Yeah, you know, I
that happens like next to never.
Never. That's what the guy said. He said, everybody brings in, you know, the violin they find, and it's always a piece of trash. But he said, this one's nice. So.
Well, when you played... when you were in Tensley, you played on that... abandoned over in over the hill and
yeah, that's right.
Buffalo.
Just took my cello
bluegrass.
With me and
bluegrass.
Took bluegrass and played. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Over,
when I was in
over the hill and in the way.
Yeah, and when I was in Montana, I played with some singer songwriters out there too. Just you know, always finding a place to play. So yeah, plug in.
That's awesome, Vanessa. I really appreciate you taking time out of your morning to hang out with your dad and I. And
yeah, well, thanks again for having me.
Dandy the Wonder Dog.
And Dandy, yeah.
It's a wonder she's not barking her ass.
Yeah, no, that's why she's a Wonder Dog.
Yeah.
She's doing good. She's coming around pretty really well.
Yeah, well, thanks
again. She's going to be ready for the field this year. Now, do you chase any birds?
I don't, no.
Okay.
I've got a lab, I got a retriever, but she didn't pick up retrieving much. I don't know her.
Yeah, it's kind of like my lab, so.
She's good at sitting.
They look good. Yeah. Talk a good game, but.
Yeah, she likes to.
Not so good in the field.
She likes to sit on the porch and watch people.
Exactly. The mellower experience.
She's mellow, yeah.
I like that. Yeah. I like that. Well, thanks again, Vanessa. Good luck. Go forward and continue doing good things.
Great. Thank you. Yeah.
Good fun with a very interesting young lady. And for our younger listeners, definitely there's a career path there. If you enjoy the outdoors, there are opportunities that are limitless and available for you. So until next time, enjoy your day, do good things, and mind your back cast.